Good evening, everyone. How are you doing? We'll continue to serve the meals, and I hope you enjoy them, but we wanted to get rolling with the program. I'm Pat Coyle. I'm one of our vice presidents with Young America's Foundation, and it's great to have all of you with us. I'd like to welcome those who are watching online. If you happen to be watching tonight's event on YouTube or Facebook Live, I would encourage you to go to yaf.org/virtualpass, where you can sign up and participate in this conference and ask questions of our speakers. Well, we are honored tonight to have with us the number one requested speaker in America, who is packing campus lecture halls across the country, Ben Shapiro. Ben is the editor-in-chief of Daily Wire, host of The Ben Shapiro Show, the top conservative podcast in the nation, of course, and a syndicated radio show heard on more than 150 stations nationwide, including 8 of the top 10 markets. He was hired by Creator Syndicate at the age of 17 to become the youngest nationally syndicated columnist in the United States. Ben is the author of 8 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, The Right Side of History, How Reason and Moral Purpose Made the West Great, which all the students have here at their seats. Of course, Ben always stands ready to defend free speech and advance timeless conservative principles to the next generation. Indeed, since the fall of 2013, Young America's Foundation has sent Ben to speak on more than 50 campuses across the country, bringing his Facts Don't Care About Your Feelings message to students. And he is a speaker that helicopter administrators fear and do all in their power to stop students from hearing his presentations. In fact, I think some of you have probably heard about some of the desperate measures administrators take to undermine his events. When Ben tried to speak at DePaul University, he was threatened with arrest by campus police if he dared set foot on campus. When we hosted Ben at UC Berkeley, we had to deal with threats of violence from NFA protesters and an openly hostile administration. At the University of Minnesota, the school relegated Ben's appearance to what is called the Cow Campus, in a venue that was 7 miles from the main school grounds. And also this spring, Grand Canyon University initially banned Ben because, quote, allowing Shapiro on GCU's campus would not be good for the school long term. Well, I think what each of these schools quickly found out was that banning Ben was probably the worst decision they could have made. And of course, all of these schools backed down when students, community members, and supporters expressed their outrage by the school's decisions. At every school he visits, where he speaks, free tickets are distributed within seconds, and Ben speaks at venues that are always filled to capacity, and of course, millions watch online. Now, we know, of course, that campus administrators may not want to hear Ben Shapiro, but time and again, it has been proven that students do want to hear from Ben Shapiro. We are honored to have him here tonight, so please give a warm welcome to Ben Shapiro.
Hey, how's it going, y'all? Well, I appreciate it. Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much. Love you too. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. I really think that it's deeply important, obviously, what Young Americans Foundation does, not just on college campuses, but for high school students. I very frequently talk to parents, and they ask me, how do I make sure that my kid ends up conservative? And I say, start now. And the kids are like 2. So starting when they are in high school is, I think, the minimum that has to be done. Honestly, by the time you get to college, if you're not set in your conservative ways, then there's a good shot that you will be perverted to the dark side by the amount of propaganda that you undergo. I want to pause for a second and say thank you to the folks who have been watching online. I know there have been several thousand people who are watching online because this is being live streamed and we're running about half an hour late. But I appreciate your forbearance. So tonight, I want to talk a little bit about activism since this is a high school activist conference. Now, normally what I would say is this is a deeply exciting time to get into politics. And it is exciting in kind of the way like a Fast and Furious movie is exciting. It's lots of car wrecks. It's got some explosions. It's really stupid. And that's fun. I mean, it makes for some fun times in politics, but it's a little more fraught than that obviously. Obviously, the stupid is first and foremost in my mind, since I cover the news cycle every single day. You know things are stupid when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is being hailed as a great intellect inside the Democratic Party. I will say there is something wonderfully amusing about watching our amazing journalistic firefighters in the media rush to defend every dumb thing that she like whatever says. This week, for example, she suggested that the detention centers down on the border, in which we process illegal immigrants, you know, the places that Democrats are trying to defund so that there aren't enough beds or resources to actually take care of those illegal immigrants. Those places she essentially compared to the Holocaust, and then she lied and said she didn't, and then she sort of admitted she did, and then she doubled down on that. She suggested that they were like concentration camps, and then never again. And the entire media rose to her defense as one, except for Chuck Todd, ironically. Weirdly enough. And they all suggested that what she actually meant was not concentration camps, you know, like Nazi concentration camps, despite the fact that she used a specific Holocaust phrase, never again. No, what they actually meant, what she actually meant was the long history of concentration camps. Because as we all know, AOC is a historian and an expert on the Boer War, which is where concentration camps began. Now, I think there's a better shot that AOC thinks a concentration camp is just a camp where people go to concentrate than that she thinks that concentration camps have anything to do with the Boer War. But I'm looking forward to the day when AOC actually declares the Earth is flat and the media rush to defend her and proclaim that she is fact-checked correct. Actually, she's right. And it's actually Donald Trump's fault. It used to be round, but now the Earth is flat because of Trump, somehow. This stupidity is extending to the Democratic primaries. Just to give you tonight's update, the Democrats are all in on bashing Joe Biden for making the relatively innocuous statement that he has worked with people whose views he considers evil and bad, including segregationists, in the past, and that they have tried to treat each other civilly. This is apparently unacceptable inside the Democratic Party, trying to treat people who disagree with you, even people whose ideas you find disgusting, civilly. You can't do that anymore. And so people are jumping all over Joe Biden. Again, I'll admit to a bit of Schadenfreude. This is the same guy who suggested that Mitt Romney was a vicious racist who wanted to put black people back in chains. So watching Joe Biden get dragged through the mud doesn't bother me any. I'm not going to lose much sleep over it. At the same time, the Democratic Party has become so radical that it does give one a sense of disquieting unease. When you feel as though the ground is moving beneath you, when you feel as though you can't say basic things that are true, things like communism is bad, or a man is a man, and a woman is a woman. If you say these sorts of things, then you're cast out of polite society. And that really means that there are stakes to this clown show. It's all dumb, but there are actual stakes to that. And that's why activism is really, truly important. So tonight I want to give you 7 tips on activism as you move forward into your college career. It shouldn't take too long, then we'll do some Q&A, which is really the fun part. So, first tip. Read. So I know everybody wants to be on TV. And listen, I've been doing this since I was 17 years old. I remember being your age wasn't all that long ago, although I can't say that for much longer. But I mean, it's starting to get weird when you guys are closer to my children's age than you are to my age. It's disturbing to me. But one of the things that there's, because there's so many media outlets, because there's such a hunger for conservative content, there is an incentive structure that leads people to get out there before they are ready. It leads people to get out in the public eye before they have fully formed thoughts. And that's a dangerous thing. I mean, as somebody who's writing a syndicated column at 17, I can guarantee you that most of my stupidest ideas came in the first 5 years of writing that column. Because when you are young, you think that every idea that comes through your head is a good one, whether it is car surfing or whether it is whatever you decide to put in a column today. What this means is that this is a great time for you to educate yourselves, to read, to know more than your peers. One of the things that they won't tell you about politics, dirty little secret about politics, people who are experts on a topic are people who have read 10 books on a topic. People who are qualified to speak on TV about a topic are people who have read an article on a topic. Be the person who reads 10 books on the topic, not the person who read the article on the topic. And this means listen more than you talk, at least for now. And the second tip is that you should understand your own principles. And this is part and parcel of reading a lot and of having discussions with folks. You really need to understand what you believe at a core root level. There's a lot of pressure in politics to sort of follow the leader. There's a lot of pressure to think like a person who you admire. And I've always encouraged folks that they shouldn't always just defend somebody they admire because they admire that person. Maybe the person has a bad idea. Now, I love Ronald Reagan. That doesn't mean that every single thing that Ronald Reagan ever did is something that I agree with. Most of what he said I agree with, and that means that he's a hero to me. He committed acts of great heroism as president of the United States. That doesn't mean that I agreed with his spending policies. I don't even think Ronald Reagan agreed with his spending policies, to be frank with you. Also, as a subset of understanding your own principles, you need to follow the evidence. And that means that you should be constantly guided by new facts and new evidence that are brought to bear. If you're not changing your mind constantly, if you're not constantly rethinking and integrating new facts, then you're not doing your job. If your perspective is so thickened that nothing is able to penetrate it, then you essentially become akin to a leftist. Because many of the folks on the left are not interested in fact, they're interested in their feelings about the world, and any fact that is brought to bear is considered taboo. If the left has a narrative that the United States is rooted in racism, sexism, bigotry, and homophobia, that all disparities are discrimination, and then they are confronted with the fact that not all disparities are discrimination, that in fact personal choice has a lot to do with both group and individual disparity, if they're confronted with any statistics along those lines, their immediate jump is to, you're a racist. Why? Because the narrative has been challenged. Don't be that. If your narrative is challenged by a fact, maybe you need to adjust your narrative to fit the fact, or maybe you need to determine whether the fact is true or not. As also part of understanding your own principles, you do have to recognize that there are certain principles that are immutable. And this is what conservatism really is about at root. Conservatism, to use the G.K. Chesterton metaphor, conservatism is different from leftism in the following way. If you're a leftist and you walk through a field and you see a fence in the middle of the field and you have no idea why that fence is there, your first instinct is to uproot the fence. I don't know why the fence is there, I'm taking it out. If you're a conservative and you see a fence in the middle of a field, your first instinct should be to say, I don't know why the fence is there. I'm going to learn why the fence is there, and then maybe I will consider whether that ought to be removed. And that means looking at the lessons of history and recognizing that they have something to teach us. This has something to do with the conservative mindset, having a level of gratitude for those who came before, trying to understand the ideas of people who came before you, and determining maybe why those ideas have been durable, what was good about those ideas, what needs to be maintained about those ideas. When folks wonder why the conservative movement has such reverence for the founding, it's because the results of the founding are the greatest upswell in human freedom and prosperity in the history of humanity. And that is also true because the founding embodied certain immutable and eternally true principles, principles we have not always lived up to, but principles that were true when they were written. And this is Lincoln's point about the Declaration of Independence. When Thomas Jefferson wrote, all men are created equal and have inalienable rights, when Jefferson wrote that, he was holding slaves at the time. But Lincoln said that was an immutable, eternal principle that we didn't live up to. And it is our job to make those principles apply to everyone the way that they were originally supposed to. It was articulated as a high principle by Jefferson for a reason, even if he didn't personally live up to that principle in his own life. Those principles matter. And the conservative principles, the ones that really matter, are limited government created solely to protect rights that come from nature and nature's God. That is conservatism in a nutshell. The founders thought that was self-evidentiarily true. I don't think it's self-evidentiarily true. I think that it is an outgrowth of 3,000 years of Judeo-Christian history and Greek reason. I think there are long roots to this. If it were self-evidentiarily true, then everyone would believe it everywhere. But it was self-evident to people who have been educated in the precepts of Western civilization and who founded the country. So educate yourself about those precepts. Realize why those principles matter. The third tip for activists, this one is very practical. Stay off social media. Stay off of it. You know, really. Have a news feed on Twitter. Have a news feed on Facebook. Check Instagram. Don't post anything for the rest of your life. Social media ruins your life. I don't just mean this in terms of you post something and then 10 years later people come after you with something that you posted, which is the current sport, the virtue signaling by which people go back into the past, grab something, then use it as a club against you. No, it doesn't matter that you're high schoolers, by the way. They'll do it. It doesn't matter. I mean, it really has no relevance what age you are. As long as you are an enemy, they will do whatever they can to ruin you. It's not just that. It's also that social media contributes to a really ugly sense of self-aggrandizement. You think people are thinking about you all the time because you're in conversations with them all the time. This is particularly true of Twitter. You know, I have very close friends who I think were very negatively affected by their overuse of social media. Don't fall into that trap. It's something I'm speaking as basically an AA member about social media here. I'm gradually attempting to wean myself from it, and I'm in withdrawal now, and it's very difficult, and relapses are frequent. But there will come a point at which I have discovered, I think, the best way to use social media. But if you can avoid it, don't get sucked into the maw that is social media, particularly too early before you have fully formed thoughts, because it's a really ugly environment out there right now. It's in time of seek and destroy. They're trying to find people and ruin them. It's not good faith conversation happening on Twitter. It's how can I ruin your life with something that you're saying today by misconstruing it or taking it out of context? That's how things work. So if you can avoid that, avoid it. A fourth tip, and this is hard given what I've just said. You need to stay open-minded to people who disagree with you so long as they are open-minded with you. And this is very difficult because sometimes you can't tell whether somebody is open-minded until you're way along in the conversation. Sometimes they act like they're open-minded and want to have a discussion, and then you realize two-thirds of the way in that this person is actually a militant activist who hates your guts and considers you a lesser human being. Still, as a good person, you should constantly, as I say, be turning over your own ideas and evaluating your own character and taking criticism seriously. At the same time, there has to be a quick protection mechanism, and that is when you realize that something is a bad faith criticism, when you realize that people are saying things to you just to be ugly or hurtful or to attack your character, the curtain has to come down immediately. It has to descend immediately, and that's the end of the conversation, and that's the end of the communication. This is probably good life advice in personal relationships as well, by the way. Surround yourself with people who are going to give you honest advice, but not people who find revelry in tearing you down or making you feel bad about yourself. The fifth tip is that, as a corollary of this, you should identify the purpose of each conversation. So I have a rule that my wife and I instituted. It's a really good rule, and you should apply it to politics as well. So the rule that I had with my wife is this. One thing that you'll notice as you get older, as you start dating, and if you're in high school, I recommend you not date. Don't do it until you're ready to get married. I'm very strict on this. I abided by the rule myself. My 11th wedding anniversary is coming up in like 2 weeks. We have two kids. We have an extraordinarily happy marriage. One of the nice things about dating for marriage, I know this is off topic. One of the nice things about dating for marriage, guys, is that, and particularly girls, if you don't want guys to objectify you, date for marriage, because this forces men to think beyond what they would like in the next 5 minutes to what they would like to deal with for the next 50 years. Marriage is very good at this. But my wife and I have a simple rule when it comes to our conversations, and this is because men and women, contrary to popular belief, and now British law apparently, men and women are actually different. And what this means is that in terms of conversation, men like to solve things in conversations, and sometimes women just want to be heard. You'll find this when you get married. You'll see. So very often my wife will come home, and this is a problem for us very early on in our marriage. She would come home, and she'd be complaining about some problem in her life. And I'd say, well, you know what you should do? You should do this, this, and this. And she'd get angry at me. And I would say, I don't understand why you're getting angry at me. You just presented me with a problem, and now I want to make the solution happen, right? You told me that the door is broken. Now I want to fix the door. And she said, no, I want to be heard. And so we came up with a solution, which is when she starts to complain about something that's happening in her day, then I say to her, is this a you want me to hear you conversation or you want me to solve this conversation? And she, being a kind, generous, and tolerant human being, goes along with this. And it's worked great because we never get mixed up along these lines. And if she doesn't want me to solve it, then I nod along. And then if she does want me to solve it, then I provide a solution, and we never get mixed up this way. It's great. It works out great. Well, you should do this with nearly every conversation you ever hold, particularly in the political sphere. You have to determine whether it's a conversation that is designed to inform you. Is it a conversation that's designed to allow you to bounce ideas off somebody? Is it a public debate where the goal is obviously to defeat the person who is across from you or to destroy their viewpoint? Right? What exactly is the purpose of the conversation? As an activist, you really do have to identify this stuff in the first 30 seconds, and very often, it's useful to disengage. Very often, there is no purpose to the conversation, so why are you wasting your time on it? Okay, the sixth point for activists is you must behave well. No matter what you purport to say, no matter what it is that you represent, understand that the best thing that you can do for your philosophy, this is true for left, right, and center, but particularly if you're conservative, where you're held to a higher behavioral standard than a lot of folks on the left. How you behave in public is how you are going to recruit people to your ideology. This is true religiously, by the way, also. And the people who tend to draw people back to their particular brand of religion are people who are happy in their religion, are people who rejoice in their life. Well, if you can rejoice in your activism, if you can be kind to people you meet and treat them civilly and treat them well, that doesn't mean don't be provocative, but it does mean that you can't be a jerk. People remember that you're a jerk long after they have forgotten what it is that you are espousing. Try to be a nice person with folks. And that doesn't mean everybody's going to be nice to you. God knows that I have tried to be nice to a lot of people. It doesn't always work for me. You know, and by the way, take all of this with a grain of salt that I myself am working on all of this, as I hope I will be until the day that I die, because we're all trying to become better human beings. But with that said, I really do try to be nice to the people that I deal with, and that does have an impact. I'll give an example. So I am a member of, in Los Angeles, I'm a member of a club called the Magic Castle, which is just a fantastic place. And when you guys hit 21, you should go to the Magic Castle, or you should come to one of the juniors' events. It's really pretty fantastic if you're into sleight of hand, that sort of thing. So the other night, my wife and I and my parents go to the Magic Castle for an hour just to see a couple of shows. And one of the shows that we see is a young guy, he's like 19, and he's gotten in because he's a junior member, and he's doing some magic. And the guy's tremendous. I mean, really, really amazing. And so I'm clapping for him. He brings me up for a trick. I'm really nice to him. Afterward, I go up and I say, you know, that was really wonderful. You're really great at what you do. I really appreciate what you do. He posts on Facebook the next day that he knew exactly who I was. And he disagrees with everything I've ever said. But it was the first time it had occurred to him that maybe just because you disagree with someone, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily a bad person. That maybe they're actually a nice person. And that if you deal with somebody on a one-on-one level, maybe you have to rethink what you think of them in terms of character. Be the person who makes people rethink in your daily life. Be that person. Okay. And then the final and seventh tip for you is that this should be fun. Now, I know it's not always going to be fun. For you guys, this age actually is a lot of fun. I remember being in college and being a troublemaker. I went to college when I was 16. And I remember that when I first was at UCLA, like very early on, I was like the only counter-protester at a 1,000-person protest over affirmative action. I used to make trouble. It was a blast. I really enjoyed myself. I was a lot crazier than I am now, which is saying a lot. And it can be a lot of fun. Don't lose the fun. Don't lose the fun. Because once you lose the fun, there's no point in doing it. That means have a sense of humor about what's happening. I know it's difficult because when you feel like things really have stakes, it's hard to have a sense of humor about it. But if you don't have a sense of humor about it, you get dour, you get negative. Everybody can read that on you. The people that people want to hang around, be with, and be convinced by are the folks who are having fun with the situation. You know, I've been of mixed review about President Trump, not on his record, which I think is largely very good, but about his affect. And the thing that I think that he does really well, when he's doing it really well, is when he's in a good mood, the dude's magnetic. When he's in a good mood, he's just a stand-up comedian riffing. And everybody knows this, right? I mean, he's not going to go up there, and he's not going to give a stump speech like Lincoln. He's going to go up there and make a bunch of heckling Don Rickles jokes about people. Is it necessarily what you'd expect from the Oval Office? I'm going to go no. But at the same time, is it something that is magnetic and interesting? Absolutely. I mean, there's a reason that he's popular when he does that sort of stuff. And you can't be Trumpian. No one can be Trump. Anybody who tries to be Trump fails because Trump is Trump. There is only one of him. Thank God. And also, the world could not handle two Donald Trumps. If they cloned him, it would be like matter and antimatter, and the entire universe would collapse in on itself like a dying star. But people who have fun in politics are the ones that people want to be around. And that's true in life as well. So make sure that you're continuing to have fun while still maintaining good character. You know, the kind of fun that you have shouldn't be at the expense of anything except bad ideas. If you're having fun at the expense of bad ideas, that is a lot of fun. I try to do it on a daily basis. So do that. All right, well, that's all that I've got. Happy to take your questions.
Hi, Ben. This question is going to be from our online viewers through our YAF virtual pass. So it's from Jude in Maryville, Tennessee. In light of the recent controversy surrounding Steven Crowder, should the government intervene to protect expression on social media?
So for those who missed it, Steven Crowder, a dude with whom I am friends, he's a comedian. You're not allowed to be a comedian on YouTube anymore. You're not allowed to say mean things about people on YouTube so long as those people work for Vox and are incredibly whiny. Is the way that this works. So basically Vox, a pseudo-journalistic outlet, and that's not a rip on everybody who works at Vox. I have a couple of friends who work at Vox who I think are actually pretty good at their jobs, but Vox overall is a garbage heap. And Vox and the Vox editorial board, like their editor-in-chief, put out a notice to YouTube asking them to rewrite their rules that they would ban Steven Crowder because he made some off-color jokes about Carlos Maza, who writes for Vox. Now, they're not jokes that I would tell. I'm also not a comedian. So with that said, I think a lot of the social media companies are There's no question that their algorithms have been biased in the past. They're, at the very least, utterly non-transparent. You cannot get in touch with them. They will not tell you what you have done wrong. They will not explain why they are benefiting certain content and not other content. And they've said in the last year and a half that they're going to start elevating what they call authoritative content, which means mainstream media content. All of that stuff I find deeply troubling and ugly. With that said, I am not a fan of government getting involved in nearly anything. And I think that the idea of having a board, so Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, who I think is a very good senator, he put forward a bill today that was specifically designed to crack down on big tech. And basically, I don't want to get too long-winded about what exactly the bill says, but the basic idea of the bill is that there would be a board that sits over these big tech companies and only allows them certain legal privileges if they can evidence, and they would have to affirmatively evidence, that their algorithms are content neutral. I don't like the idea of a government board sitting over anybody and determining their content. I just think that that is a, I think it may be unconstitutional, number one, but I think that it is a large-scale mistake, because what happens when it's President Kamala Harris, God forbid, who is appointing the members of the Federal Trade Commission, who now have to sign off on the algorithms used by Facebook? Do you think that maybe these companies are going to start catering to President Kamala Harris to get their immunity? I'm very wary of government involvement on all of these issues. I see the rationale for it. I see the pressure. If it's a pressure tactic, great. I mean, if this is just Josh Hawley trying to push these folks to be more transparent, good on him. But if, as an actual piece of legislation, not in favor.
Hi, Ben. My name's River Schreckengast, and I'm going to be a freshman at Colorado School of Mines next year. And coming from a place where school shootings are so prevalent, especially in that area, and with the stigma of the Columbine shooting especially, and STEM that just happened, I was wondering if you could share some of your insight on how we as a community and as conservatives can help fix this problem.
So I think that it really is a community problem, and also, so a couple of things. I think that there is a notion that has been prevalent in American politics for a very long time, which is that for every problem there is a government solution. And I just don't think that that is necessarily the case. I think that tragedies occur. I think acts of evil occur. I don't think the government is capable of stopping all of those. If the government were capable of stopping all of those, then it should have enforced its own laws in half the cases of mass shootings in which some law was broken or some red flags were used. The government can't even enforce the laws on its books. Passing more laws to take more guns away from law-abiding citizens isn't going to make anybody any safer in these isolated incidents. I see the arguments for gun control. I don't find them convincing, but I find them particularly non-convincing when you're talking about statistical outliers like mass shootings. Second, if you are actually looking to stop mass shootings, in my opinion, the only way to do that is to have more armed guards at schools. I think you have to solidify the schools.
Thank you.
As a final note on that, when I choose my kids' schools, I specifically choose my kids. Listen, we're Jewish and I'm somewhat notorious, and we are conservative, which means we get an awful lot of death threats, which means that my kids' safety is first and foremost in my mind. When we pick their schools, security is the first thing that we check out, and we ensure that the place is hard-lined. We ensure that the place has armed guards outside. I've said before that we guard our money better than we guard our kids, and that's true. I don't see why that should be the case.
Hi, Ben. This is another virtual pass question from our online viewers. This is from Eduardo in Huntersville, North Carolina. What is your opinion of Teddy Roosevelt's presidency, and how does 1900s progressivism differ from modern progressive approaches?
So the question, for people who can't hear, was about TR's presidency. So Teddy Roosevelt, I'm not a fan. Teddy Roosevelt was inspired by German-style progressivism. He was a big believer in sort of the powerful leader who could move the chains of history forward using a vast administrative state, moving beyond partisan politics, we'd move beyond the boundaries of the Constitution. Teddy was a real activist as an individual, and so he's an activist as a member of government, breaking apart, trust-busting big companies, not really in the name of competition, but simply as a matter of government activism and as a matter of opposing that which was big. He was very into the idea of an administrative government. And then that, of course, was taken to its logical conclusion by Woodrow Wilson, the worst president in the history of the United States, with the possible exception of James Buchanan. So the German progressivism that had already infused Teddy was taken even further by Woodrow Wilson and has ended with the vast growth of the administrative state, the idea that it's the government's job to provide positive rights, not just protect negative rights. Positive rights are the idea that the government is supposed to provide you services, as opposed to the government is there to protect life, liberty, and property. That's the difference between the two types of rights. I'm working on a new book on this right now, actually, so excellent question. As far as how does that progressivism differ from modern-day progressivism? Well, that progressivism was more closely tied to things that today we consider overtly evil, right? Woodrow Wilson was in favor of eugenics. Woodrow Wilson was a vicious anti-Semite. Woodrow Wilson was a vicious racist. Teddy Roosevelt had some of these same tendencies with regard to race. He was more progressive than Wilson was on it. Not in the German progressive sense, but he was more progressive than Wilson. But a lot of these, this idea that scientific government was the wave of the future is really ugly, because there is no cadre of wise people who are capable of governing an entire state because they have all of the answers. And that's what progressivism is based on. That mentality extends down to today. It extends through FDR. It extends down today, where you have the left basically suggesting that their cultural mandarins ought to, from on high, impose their values on the entirety of the United States, whether it is from the Supreme Court or whether it is through executive order. That is ugly stuff. The federal government needs to be whittled down to size, and that means slashing and burning through entire departments of the federal government, removing the federal government from our lives and making it insignificant the way that it once was, restricting it to its constitutional duties. And the left caricatures that is saying, well, now you're fine with the federal government not intervening, for example, when a state is being racially discriminatory. No, I'm not in favor of that. It was a delegated power of the federal government under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution to provide equal protection of the laws. That is still a delegated power of the federal government of the United States. It's all the non-delegated powers that they have sucked up and grabbed away from you and your local community and your state and you individually that is really terrifying.
Hello, my name is Stephen Halbert. I go to Upland High School, and I'm curious about your rules on playing devil's advocate.
I'm sorry, say one more time. It's a bit of an echo.
One moment. What are your rules on playing devil's advocate?
My rules on playing devil's advocate?
Yes.
So, fun to do, but I prefer sincerity. So, I mean, it depends, again, on the purpose of the conversation. So, if I'm trying to elucidate a view and get more clarity, then playing devil's advocate is useful. If you're playing devil's advocate just to be a tool, then not in favor of it. And I know that there are a lot of people who like to do this. It's fun for them just to kind of twist the knife. And when you're talking about people's sincerely held beliefs, I'm not a big fan.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Ben. My name is Caitlin. I'm going off to Chapman University next year. So a couple of questions. First off, my career focus is to be a political public speaker. And so past 6 months, I've been working on creating my own social media platform. But given what you just said, what is the best way to go about doing that so that I can actually avoid all the evil that is going on social media while still actually being an activist in the public eye and not just, you know, on college campuses, but eventually speaking for like YAF and Turning Point? And then the second question is, where do you draw the line between being an active and influential activist and effective in that, but also not shoving your ideas down people's throats at the same time?
Well, so when it comes to, I'll answer the second question first, because that's very easy. When it comes to shoving your ideas down other people's throats, as long as you're not using the government gun to do it, you're not shoving your ideas down their throats. There's no, if I say something to you and you don't like it, I'm not shoving my idea down your throat. And one of the things that irritates me most about the left's view of rhetoric these days and discussion these days is that if I express a view they don't like, this is me forcing my view on them. It's like, well, if you don't like my view, you don't have to listen to it. If you don't want to listen to my show, you don't have to tune in, right? So I don't buy that very much. As far as the first question about social media, what I would say is that social media is a wonderful marketing tool, but you have to use it as such. So you can't get sucked into sort of the back and forth and the personal investment in, oh, people care about what I say. You just have to use it the same way you would if you were buying a billboard, basically. That social media is a billboard that you are using to get out your message. And if you can use it that way, then it's an amazing tool. I mean, I'd be hypocritical to say otherwise. I use social media routinely, obviously. I have 2.2 million Twitter followers and like 5 million Facebook followers, and we use social media extensively at my company, at Daily Wire. So with that said, you do have to, it has a proper role. I'm just saying that on a personal level, if you're tweeting, for example, think it's something I didn't do 10 years ago, and so, you know, poorly worded tweets come out. Think three times about whether it is worth tweeting it, and another three times about what it is you are actually tweeting. You know, or, I mean, listen, if President Trump had that, he'd be up in the polls by 10 points right now. Right? I mean, I have actively recommended to people in the White House that they construct a fake Twitter app for President Trump's phone in which he just tweets out at the world, and then fake Twitter responses are provided to him, hashtag MAGA, And he just sits there and he cavils and he's super happy and none of it ever sees the light of day. And people don't understand why he's so happy all the time, but the media is never actually reporting on this. And then he wins re-election by like 35 points.
Hi, my name is Ava Von Lipinski. I go to Beverly Hills High School, but I graduated at 16, just like you. So now I'm going to UCLA.
Wow, congratulations.
And I actually plan to go to Harvard Law after that. So kind of like identical like you.
Okay.
And my question is based on how to deal with the bias that teachers impose in school, because a lot of my friends that are conservative, especially me, we write papers, and they're opinion-based papers. And say if I was writing about Kavanaugh and defending him, I got an F on that paper. And I don't think that's fair. And I was wondering how you deal with that and also the hate that the liberals throw at the conservatives constantly.
Yeah, I mean, dealing with hate, you just have to grow a thick skin. And every time I think personally I've grown a thick enough skin, I realize I have to have another layer of skin. I mean, at this point I look like the Thing from the Fantastic Four. But it doesn't matter. I still need more layers of skin. There's never a point where as a human being it doesn't still hurt when people attack you, obviously. But you just deal with it and move on because you really have no other choice. As far as how you deal with teachers, so I have this long-running feud with Dennis Prager, my friend Dennis, about this specific issue. So Dennis is wonderful. Dennis hasn't been in college for 50 years. And so we have this conversation, and we've had it in public on his show many times. So you're in class, you know that your teacher is basically a Bernie Sanders communist, and you know that if you write a paper about gun rights or Ronald Reagan or about supply-side economics, that you're going to get a bad grade. Should you write that paper? So Dennis is like, yeah, you should be honest. You should be very honest. And you should always be deeply honest about your personal convictions. And I say that's a bunch of hooey. I say that granting the power to bad people to control your future out of a misguided sense that you are doing something useful is a waste. You're not at, like, keep your eye on the prize. You're at UCLA in order to get into Harvard Law. That means you don't want to get a C. You don't want to get a D. And no one's going to read the paper anyway as your legitimate viewpoint. It's all written in an anonymous blue book. So what I used to do in class when I was at UCLA is I'd speak exactly as I thought in class because there's no way for that to affect my grade. So I would be very militant. I would argue with teachers. Some of them liked it. Some of them didn't. And then when it came time for the test, I'd write exactly what the teacher wanted to hear, and I'd get an A. You know, it's funny because there will be people on the left who say, well, that's dishonest. No, because what tests are about in college, particularly in political science, which is the most useless major ever devised by God or man, if you're in a poli-sci course, you are not being tested on actual material. You're being tested on how well you mirror the mind of the professor. That is what the test is. And, I mean, frankly, it's a skill set. I mean, you can consider it as, okay, now I know how to argue from the other side, which is actually kind of a useful skill set. So I'm a little more Machiavellian than my friend Dennis on this.
This is our last virtual pass question, and this one is coming from Nick in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Why did Hollywood turn out to be so leftist?
Why did Hollywood turn out to be so leftist? So, fortunately for you, I have an entire 400-page book on precisely this topic. It's called Primetime Propaganda. Get it at your nearby bookstore or if out of stock at Amazon.com and help put my kids through college. So when Hollywood was founded, it was not leftist. When Hollywood was founded, it was actually founded by a bunch of Jewish Republicans, just like virtually every major industry in the history of the United States. Not founded by Jews, but founded by people who tend to be conservative. Jews are outsized in their influence, but not always Republicans and not at the head of every industry, unlike the Protocols of Elders of Zion say. Meetings at Friday night at my synagogue for running the banking guys. So, but in any case, when it comes to Hollywood, basically it was founded by a lot of very entrepreneurial folks who were directly aiming at the American market. And then over the course of time, a lot of the creatives became the executives. This particularly happened in the television industry. It started to happen in Hollywood in the 1950s, maybe, when Hollywood started to unionize. By that point, Hollywood unions had actually been taken over, in many cases, by the communists. If you read Ronald Reagan's history, a lot of his history is specifically about him becoming conservative after seeing the communists attempting to radicalize the Hollywood unions, because Reagan was a lifelong Democrat up till that point. So the shift happened when a lot of the creative types who didn't know anything about politics and who felt artists, I mean, I grew up in the home of my dad's a professional musician. My mom works in Hollywood. artists tend to feel excised by the prevailing society typically, and so they tend to feel like outsiders, and this makes them feel like they have to cut against the prevailing winds of values. And that tends to bleed over into art. They're always the rebels. And once they become the executives, then they can sort of cram that down on everybody else in Hollywood to the point where the way that they justify making all sorts of money and yet being socialists is by saying, well, I'm using my privilege for good. How am I doing that? By making this movie about a transgender Native American little person who suffers tremendous discrimination at the hands of John Lithgow, who's running a small town where he won't let anyone dance. And that's my contribution to the world. Right? That's sort of the mentality in Hollywood, unfortunately. They make the Marvel movies and get all you suckers to buy tickets so that they can make the movies they truly care about, which are the social justice movies no one will ever see, but they can brag their friends about at cocktail parties. So there was an actual evolution. It's a little longer story than that in TV, but that's sort of the nutshell story.
Hi, Mr. Shapiro. I'm John Austin, and I come from a religious family, so that's cool. I'm guessing you do, too.
was the hat the giveaway?
Maybe just a little bit. Anyways, I was just wondering how your religious views have influenced your political views, and if your views on your religion have ever changed, or a part of your religion have ever changed?
I mean, I think that if you're a religious person, then you're constantly struggling with your own faith and evolving in your own faith. One of the things that I think secular people don't appreciate about religious people is how much we actually think about our religion. And there tends to be this view in secular society that religious people never struggle with faith, never struggle with God, never struggle with how to act out their faith in their daily life, never struggle over principle. It's a bunch of hooey. I say religious people struggle with their faith a lot more than secular people struggle with their secularism. That's for sure. So, I mean, not to start quoting, you know, the Bible at you, but the fact is that the term Israel, which comes from the Hebrew Yisrael, literally means struggle with God, right? When Jacob is renamed Israel after he wrestles with the angel, then the idea is that Jacob becomes Israel, and the house of Israel and all of this, becomes Israel because he has struggled with God and overcome. Faith is about that struggle with basic principles. Is there justice in the universe? How much of God's plan can I understand or deal with? This is what it means to be a faithful person. To be a faithful person means to have faith that at the end of the day, God knows better than you do. But that doesn't mean you don't struggle with that. Of course you struggle with that. And you evolve and become more nuanced in your thinking sometimes. And other times you realize that ancient truths are just true and there's nothing to argue with there. As far as how it's influenced sort of my political thinking, I think there are certain fundamental principles that lie at the heart of a natural law philosophy that undergirds the founding that have roots in Sinaitic tradition, in Judeo-Christian tradition. I talk about this a lot in The Right Side of History. My new book is basically about this, and it discusses contributions of Judeo-Christian values to secular worldviews, things like free will, things like the universe is not a chaotic mishmash of crap happening, but it's actually an ordered place. And there was an orderer of that ordered place. And it is your duty, in order to investigate God, to investigate the universe around you. I mean, this leads to a lot of developments in science and the philosophy that science is a way of investigating God, which is why you have Thomas Aquinas writing full-on summae, which are, you know, encyclopedias about the knowledge that we have about the world. The sort of false history that's been taught that science was dead until 1790 is just not true. The false history that we've been taught that human rights were dead until 1790 is not true. It's much more of a continuum than anything else. And the contributions of religion to modern life are most evident when you remove religion from modern life, at which point virtue tends to fall out through the bottom floor, and then you end up with so-called rights without any responsibility, so-called rights without virtues or duties. You end up with a libertine population that feels that their signal achievement is to express themselves without regard to anybody else, and that inevitably leads to more government overreach, actually. So how does all of this play into my politics? It does at a very fundamental level, but in terms of how I argue, it doesn't. What I mean by that is I've never cited God in an argument as an authority. Mm-hmm. I just don't do it. I don't think that it's worthwhile. I don't think it's valuable, mainly because I'm talking to people very often who don't believe in God or who are alienated by that argument, who don't believe in the veracity of the Bible. And so I've always said that if I can't argue a policy on a secular level, then I won't back the policy. Right? If I can't give you a secular rationale for a policy that I am espousing, then I'm not going to argue in favor of the policy. And this means that I am libertarian in areas of government, even if I consider the exercise of a particular right to be sinful. This is something the left can't deal with, by the way. The leftists really can't understand why I would allow people to commit sins. And the idea is because I'm a free, independent human being, and so are you, and this gives you the right to exercise your free will, which means sometimes you're going to sin. I'm not God. I don't get to sit over you and force you to do what I want so long as you're not damaging anybody else. It's funny, they sort of want to convince me that if I think something is sinful, that in and of itself is bad. My response to that has always been, why do you give a damn what I think? Really, I mean, why do you care what I think of your behavior? Guess what? As an Orthodox Jew, I'm extraordinarily judgmental about a lot of human behavior. Like a lot of it. We have 613 commandments, and that is like just the tip of the iceberg. Right? Every aspect of our life is governed. There are tons of things that people do that I find abhorrent. Does that mean that I think that they as people are abhorrent? No, because I think that sin is abhorrent, but people who sin are just called people. And also, I think that I don't have the right to stop people from sinning through the force of government. I think people have the obligation to pursue a more virtuous life, but that's not something I'm going to cram down because I'm not a theocrat. So that's in essence, religious virtue governs my private life. It governs how I raise my children. It governs how I live in my community. It doesn't govern how I think laws ought to be made.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, here's another YAF virtual pass question from Avi in Brooklyn, New York. What's the best way to combat growing hate, specifically anti-Semitism?
The best way to combat hate is to call it out even-handedly wherever you see it, Democrats. So when it comes to anti-Semitism in particular, lately this has become a real political football where certain people believe that the only type of anti-Semitism that exists is white supremacy. Well, white supremacists are evil, vicious, moronic pieces of human debris. I don't know any milder way to put it because they don't deserve it. They're the worst people that I personally have ever dealt with. It is not close. I have 24/7 security largely because of my opposition to white supremacists who I've been calling out consistently, right? And members of the alt-right who I've been calling out consistently. The hilarious part of that is, of course, the left then terms me a member of the alt-right that wants to murder me, so that's always a party. But I'm willing to call out the alt-right. I'm willing to call out white supremacists. I'm willing to call out, it was funny, I was on TV one time, and I was talking to a member of the Council on American Islamic Relations, which is unwilling to condemn terror very often. And I said, why won't you condemn Hamas? And he said, well, why won't you condemn the KKK? And I said, I'm happy to condemn the KKK, that piece of crap. And he was stunned. And he's like, why would you be stunned by that? I'm confused, like the KKK is evil. If you're not willing to call out all anti-Semitism, you're not against anti-Semitism. You're just in favor of using anti-Semitism in order to target your political opponents. And that's what you're seeing from Democrats today. It's disgusting. It's where you're seeing Democrats defend the open anti-Semitism of Rashida Tlaib and the very, very slightly veiled anti-Semitism of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the open anti-Semitism of Ilhan Omar, and they won't even pass a simple anti-Semitism resolution in the House for fear of alienating the anti-Semites in their caucus. So I'm not gonna take hints on what matters to the Jewish community from a bunch of people who refuse to condemn folks who say that Jewish influence in America is all about the Benjamins. I'm not gonna take Nancy Pelosi's view on anti-Semitism seriously because she's utterly full of it.
Hi, Mr. Shapiro. My name's Haley Pitschke, and I'm from South High School. And I was wondering what your opinion was on programs and legislature like emissions trading, where the government takes advantage of free market principles in order to pursue a political agenda.
So what kind of training?
Emission trading, like carbon cap and trade.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm not familiar with those sorts of programs, to be honest with you. My general viewpoint is that most education ideally would be done by local communities, not at the behest of the federal government, and mostly done in private hands. I don't like the idea of the government cramming down its viewpoint on people, just as a general rule. So that holds pretty much across the board, by the way. I mean, I'm just not in favor of the government being involved in this area of American life, and I don't see their warrant for doing so, other than mandating that parents do educate their children. I don't see why it's up to a bunch of bureaucrats in Washington who don't know my kids' name to tell my kids what is good and what is bad.
Thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Mr. Shapiro. My name is Adam Huser. I'm from Providence Academy in Minnesota. My question has to do with abortion and mostly how recently, with the passing of the abortion laws in a couple of states banning abortion, there's been a new opportunity for argument between pro-life and pro-choice people. And I've found that the pro-choice people really, when it comes down to it, have different principles and are willing to deny aspects of the natural law, such like that human life has inherent value. And I'm wondering, what do you do when you reach a point in an argument that they're willing to deny the natural law?
I mean, there's nothing you can do at that point. I mean, there are arguments where you just reach root argument and there is no way to bridge that gap. I mean, clarity, I'll quote Prager this time in favor of a statement that he made. Dennis is constantly saying clarity over agreement, and I totally agree with that. I mean, I'd prefer to clarify the views of people I'm arguing with, and if they reach a point where they're saying that a human life is not a human life, or that a human life doesn't matter, or that murder is okay as long as it's inside the womb, or that, you know, they're okay with killing babies who are outside the womb in some extreme cases, right? When you get to that point, you're like, okay, then we're finished here, right? There are stopping points in conversations beyond which you really cannot go. And we live in a polity, so that's just the way things are going to be. That doesn't mean they're not extraordinarily wrong.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Shapiro. My name is Joey Stone. I'm from Vanden High School in Fairfield, California. I was just wondering, what are your views on Colorado's new, I guess, option to push communism at all costs?
To push?
Communism.
Communism? Well, I mean, I'm not aware of the kind of provision that you're talking about in Colorado law. So I'd have to be familiar with what the provision is of law. Obviously, communism bad. Also evil. Also
true.
Killed 100 million people. So I'm bewildered by people. I'm bewildered by people who are romantic toward communism. It is a gift of being of growing up in a one thing that all the communists who live in America have in common is that they live in America. Yeah, move to Cuba and then tell me how wonderful communism is without being a part of the prevailing regime. It's easy for Michael Moore to talk about the glories of the Cuban healthcare system while he has his WGA card. It's a little bit different when Michael Moore, you know, would have to live there, which of course he never will. The people who are the most anti-communism in America are people who left communist countries, right, who actually lived in these places. There's such an inherent level of ingratitude in America right now, it's astonishing to me. People who were born on third base and think they hit a triple. People who live in the most prosperous, free, and wonderful country in the history of the world, bar none, not close. If you could be born any time in any place, it would be right here and right now. You're guaranteed basically 8 decades on this earth of health, wealth, and ease. And you're sitting around going, you know, it'd be better if we got rid of everything that undergirds this, and then we do stuff that's fair. And fair means what I like. Well, I'm sorry, but the world did not begin spinning when you got here. The principles that you hold are not unique to you, and your wealth is not a natural part of life. People tend to just believe that this is normal, that what happens in America is normal, that the norm of human life is this. That is so not only historically ignorant, but just ignorant of contemporaneous circumstance anywhere outside the West. If people actually had the ability to take a time machine, then they might be a little bit more grateful for what it is they have here in the United States. And fortunately, there is a time machine. It's called an airplane. All you have to do is take that airplane to a third world country, and you will quickly recognize that the United States is a damned phenomenal place.
Hello, Ben. My name is Joseph Green from Playbob Airport Preparatory Academy. I was wondering, with so many voters these days that seem completely not knowing anything about what they're voting on or even American history, do you think there should be some kind of preliminary test that you have to take, like the citizenship test or something like that?
So, I mean, in sort of stark philosophical terms, I don't oppose something like that. Obviously, that would have to be based on knowledge, not discrimination. So there used to be these poll tests that were actually applied in order specifically to discriminate against particular groups. Nothing like that, obviously. You don't want to discriminate against particular groups. But I think that having a basic level of knowledge about the American political system would certainly be of benefit to the voting population. A more informed citizenry is certainly a better thing. In philosophy, I'm not against it. In practice, I think it would be sort of hard to apply.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I think that's it. Great, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Is that it? Do we have one more? Okay, sorry. People are moving forward slowly. What's going on? That was the last question. Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.